we have a roll call? Roll call?
Yeah. Everyone is present, except for Brandon and Alan and Stephen sending messages that they won't be able to make it. I have not heard from Brandon, so I don't know if he's still his way. Yeah, that's what I assume.
Okay. And the approval of the minutes, has everybody had a chance to read the minutes? And the November 3rd meeting?
I'll move approval.
Do I have a second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, thanks. All right, well, we got a lot on the agenda this evening, so I'm going to try to move the meeting right along. But first, I'd like to welcome the new board members, Chris Cathero and Warren Neff over there. We probably should do introductions around, so maybe you two could start and give us a little brief history on yourselves.
I'm Chris Prothero. I'm representing Southwest Clark County. I've lived here for about 17 years. I work in the medical field, trying to be more active in the community on top of refereeing high school football around the area for the last 14 years. My biggest thing right now is spending time with the grandkids.
Cool. I understand that. Warren?
Warren Neff. I work for Slow Food Southwest Washington. Local food advocacy group in town, and I'm the agricultural representative, and one of our programs for our organization is if you have a fruit tree in your backyard, you can register with us. We'll go out and harvest that fruit and bring it into the food bank. So we deal a lot with fruit, which I guess is supposed to be one of the triggers for this position, that there is a transfer of so it's not quite big ag Wenatchee stuff, but so it'll be interesting to hear try to keep my ear to the ground from the farming community on ways that we can kind of improve our services for waste stream management in general. I've always just appreciated what the county's been doing through compost education and recycling programs, and just like to know what's happening behind the scenes and how things are getting done, and appreciate what you guys have been doing. So,
okay.
Nice job.
Melissa, do you want to start?
My name is Melissa Sutton. I work for Clark County Public Health. I'm the solid waste enforcement piece of public health, program one. We've expanded now to also include some of our SPO people. As well, so I'm excited to have some new folks to help me with solid waste enforcement and working through coordination of our solid waste efforts in the community.
My name is Peter Lyon. I'm the manager of ecology for the Waste Resources Program. Waste Resources are a fancy way of saying solid waste. We basically write the state rules and we help counties implement them and interpret them. We're involved with county planning. We give out grants, and oddly enough, I also deal with biosolids.
So I'm Simone Auger, and I am representing small towns and cities, and I'm a lighting specialist with Energy Trust in the commercial and industrial lighting program. Welcome, new folks.
Nice to meet you all. I'm Rich McConaughey with the City of Vancouver, so I'm new to the SWAC. We did have a city council member that was sat on SWAC for years and years, and then they, since there were no other elected officials, they said, you know, maybe we shouldn't have an elected official, let's have some staff. So I've been with the city's solid waste program for 18 plus years. So I'm just kind of a SWAC geek. I hang out every time anyhow. So you have to move up to the big person's table, I guess.
My name is Allie Cooper. I'm a teacher at Kansas High School. My big thing is proper disposal of waste and waste reduction at school. So, welcome.
My name is Rem Wilson. I represent Southeast Clark County. I'm a principal in an engineering firm in Portland. We specialize in sustainable buildings. And I've been in the Vancouver area for 30-some years now, and just want to help contribute. So,
flammable. Scott Campbell, representing the solid waste industry.
I'm Chuck Harmon, program manager here at Clark County Public Health. Currently, well, I have responsibilities historically with solid waste enforcement, and then with SWEO coming over, the team from former Environmental Services, I'm also now involved in the operations side of solid waste in the county.
And for new folks, SWEO is solid waste and environmental outreach. It's a division that was formerly in Environmental Services, and now it's moved over to Public Health under. So my name is Kim Morales. I work for solid waste operations side of our division in Environmental Public Health. So mostly involved with our haulers and the transfer stations and a number of programs.
Yeah. I'm Jenna Williams. I'm the office assistant for the SWEO group.
And then we'll go to the back for other staffing guests.
Sure, I'm Jeff Smith with Waste Connections.
I'm Chris Robertson, I'm a resident of Clark County.
Cindy Steinbarger, I'm with SWEO, I do outreach and education.
Michelle Pasimich, I'm in the Green Schools Program.
My name is Tanya Gray, I'm with the City of Vancouver in the Solid Waste Department.
Okay, well, thank you for that. We're excited to have Chris and Warren to join us. We can all get into some pretty good discussions at different times, so welcome aboard. I see public health reorganization and staff update.
Yeah, thanks. I just wanted to spend a few minutes because I know that, you know, most of you know that we, you know, this transition of environmental services last year, and then there was three divisions, but the solid waste environmental outreach division was came to public health, and we've been working, you know, with that new team. I think I just want to get, I know at an earlier meeting, you know, Dr. Alan Melnick, the health director, and our director, we would say, you know, we're very pleased. There's so many great professionals working with that group, so it's been great to have them join us. Obviously, it takes a lot of energy and to move them and begin to integrate as a team. But so we just also wanted to do some updates on staffing and sort of organization. Now, this org chart is just the total of the Environmental Health Division, which includes the solid waste programs, plus some other programs in food safety, on-site water, et cetera. So what all I really wanted to do, because I don't want to go over this whole thing, is just focus on the solid waste components and the program and the management of those. So real quick, one other change, and she was going to be here tonight, is that one of the leadership team members, our Chief Performance Officer, Janice Koch, is now the direct manager for myself, Cindy, and the other manager in Environmental Public Health right now, Jim Laxon. The program coordinator position that used to exist, I know several of you was Andrew, what's the manager's last name?
Losher,
sorry. Andrew Losher. Andrew resigned and went to work at a local office of the Bonneville Power Administration. So a great loss, but I think he saw some interesting opportunity, and but already folks are already like, how are we going to get a lot certain things done? But he's moved on, and that position at this point is vacant. So basically focusing in, and then I may have Cindy talk a little bit about some of the new staff in her group, but right now, as you can see, if you go over to solid waste enforcement, I supervise the enforcement program and work with Melissa and with Mike Davis, who's not here tonight, and Kim, on all the fun things that happen in those programs. And then Cindy oversees the SWEO team, so I would just turn it over to her. Can you see that? There's a lot of new staff here.
Wait, memory, so.
Here, I can also focus in.
That's okay. Well, we have our core staff, which is four outreach specialists that manage the main programs, the Green Schools, Green Business, Green Neighbors, and Master Composter Recyclers, and that's Pete, Sally, Sarah, and Michelle here. And then we were recently able to fill our two vacant program tech positions, which support those programs and part of operations. And Hannah Marino came on in December, and Jill Krumloff, we just hired, she actually had some time in Olympia working in their solid waste department several years ago, so she's a great addition. And then we currently have four AmeriCorps people that some will be leaving us in May, and one, Jessica, will be here through August. And then also we have Eric Lambert, who's new to our staff. He's doing clean water outreach, actually 75% funded by the Clark County Clean Water Program, which is in Public Works, and 25% funded by Environmental Public Health to do other related type work, maybe with the Swim Beach Program and other programs with the Environmental Public Health. So Eric used to work for Clark County, WSU Clark County Extension. He was our Small Acreage Program Coordinator, and now he will be the one to manage that contract with Extension.
So, thanks, Cindy. Uh-huh. And so, I just wanted to sort of give you everyone a snapshot of the folks working in solid waste. Again, as we move forward with these meetings and share information, you'll probably see a lot of these names and folks will come to these meetings to present, but I thought it was good to catch up. Again, just to sort of capture it with all the, it's been, as you might expect, a pretty busy time, a lot of transition, and then like a lot of new staff, so it's kind of exciting, but also creates a lot of extra things to deal with, but it's been very good.
Chuck, yes, can we get a copy of that?
Yeah, we can send that out.
That'd be great, thank you.
So,
what's RACR?
Oh, sorry, yeah. So the Water Resources and Protection. So that's a group that oversees on-site septic system permitting and also drinking water and on-site operation and maintenance programs in the county. So great, so we'll move on.
Yeah, Chuck, move right into Clark County Public Health.
Great. So real quick, I just wanted to, a couple of quick things. I'll just talk to the, we just got all of our reporting in for the quarterly reporting for the end of 2016. I think that report was that Melissa puts together to submit to Ecology for the enforcement grant has been submitted, and that was provided, I think, in the CP in the Eagle database format. So if there were any questions about that, let me know. But again, you know, we're continuing to move forward on that grant and get a lot of the facility inspections done and complaint response, and so there's been quite a very busy quarter, last quarter for Melissa. And then the last thing I just want to mention is we have an enforcement action. I was just going to talk briefly about it. We mentioned at an older meeting where there was someone who was not properly burying dead animals. They had many dead animals. It was in an operation near Brush Prairie about a year ago. It was a terrible situation, lots of manure, improperly managed. Someone thinking they were composting by sticking animals, they're smaller, in piles of exposed bedding manure. It was very bad. So that's an ag thing. But nonetheless, we worked with this individual. We connected them with the local soil water conservation district, got them a plan to manage better, hold down the number of animals, et cetera, et cetera. And that individual failed. They did not follow the plan. They had much more animals on there. I think this time when you were there, well, you can talk a little bit more about what you observed. Oh. Well, I'm sorry, but the basic, there were no dead animals this time, at least, thank goodness. And one of the other requirements is that they just dispose of the dead animals through a contract with the hauler. But nonetheless, the quick update I wanted to do was they failed, and so originally we had there was a series of fines that had accrued because they didn't come into compliance soon enough. Of about $7,000, we waived most of that and just reduced it to $500 on the condition that they move forward with the rest of the plan. Since they haven't, we're now moving forward with the rest of the fine, about $6,000, because they did not comply with the corrective action.
This is a business?
It's a gentleman who's raising animals for rodeos and things like that. Sport.
Their sport cattle is what he refers to them.
Sport cattle?
Sport cattle. So he leases them out for various ranching, rodeo events around the state and around Oregon and Washington. Sometimes he takes them long distances to Texas and such. This particular case just a side note, the property is about 45 acres. Approximately 20 acres are designated wetland, and about 15 to 18 other acres are designated hydric soils under mapping through GIS. So because of the site conditions, that's why they aren't allowed to bury the animals. And December of 2015, Animal Control had gone out and observed in a 3-week period, there were 17 deceased animals and a herd of about 80. And they had a veterinarian go out and determine that the animals had died from malnutrition and also parasitic. It was quite devastating to go out there, but they were just buried in heaps of manure. Some of them were just left to decompose amongst the rest of the herd, so that's why public health got involved. There were portions where we were walking through manure that went almost capsized the top of my rubber boots when I was out there. So about 12 to 18 inches of manure going into an old dairy lagoon that's unlined, and so there was a lot of environmental concerns out there.
When did this come on the radar?
It was about a year ago.
About a year ago, January of 2016, we were notified by Animal Control.
Gotcha.
We issued fines and such starting at the end of January. We met with their attorney. We got them a best farm management plan in place in June, allowed them 5 or 6 months to start implementing that best farm management plan. And when I went out there at the end of November, there had been no improvements other than the fact there were no dead animals there, which is an improvement in and of itself, but the manure management piece was still compromised. I did get a call from the property owner, leases it to this farmer, and it's in a trustee, so I did speak with the gentleman's daughter, who's in his 80s, the property owner. So the cows are gone. I'm gonna go out there on Monday morning. There's still a lot of manure management issues. The dairy lagoon, they have an irrigation well that's not utilized. The cattle were around and there were no perimeter fencing in place. So there are some other issues that we'll be looking at, but trying to get the property owner's family connected with our Clark Conservation District so that they can have better manure management, maybe borrow some equipment or find a way to compost that and utilize that manure through the manure share program is my hope.
And you said the cattle were off the premises. Is that a permanent or are they just out on lease?
It sounds like they are permanently relocated. Yeah.
She hasn't had a chance to go out to look at it.
I just got a call this afternoon. I didn't even get a chance to talk to Chuck before I left today. Hopefully permanently.
Yeah, and I just raised it from the standpoint of, for us, we have to work with either this operator or the owners, but we're going to pursue collecting this fine, and it's pretty substantial. We would have preferred not to. The fines and the violations are used to compel action, and it didn't work. So I think it could come up in the news eventually. I don't know that it will. I have no, but I just wanted to mention it because it is a pretty... relatively speaking, a pretty large fine for this type of thing. But again, we followed a pattern of finding the violations, clear solid waste violations, giving them an opportunity to work with us to perform and to improve the conditions and manage at a higher level for protection of public health. And it didn't happen. And so we feel that we've set a good path forward. And then again, I think ultimately, if the owners, which would be regrettable, they could pay the fine. If that occurred, we would certainly want to, I would use some of those resources to do some evaluation of the area as far as impacts, like test some wells. But if the family wanted to settle, then we could also work on things they could do to remove those waste and all that, because there's a lot of environmental liability on that property. Anyway, I just wanted to bring that to your attention.
And Clark County Animal Control is pursuing case against the Carroll rancher for animal cruelty charges. So it was pretty egregious.
Well, it sounds like you gave him an opportunity to do the right thing. So
yeah. So that's all I'm just going to talk about tonight.
And,
yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Oh.
Is it now a good time for me to update other public health things?
Well, we have you on the agenda for Circle C later.
Just really quick, City of Vancouver has notified public health that in December we met with the ecology staff, Chuck Matthews. They are hoping, they have a sludge lagoon near the old Roofner landfill on Lower River Road, and where they have food grade sludge, so it is not biosolids. I want to make sure that everyone knows it's not human waste biosolids, it is a food grade sludge. It's wastewater from Frito-Lay's plant and also Great Western Maltings operations, and they're hoping to, they have under Department of Agriculture had a permit to utilize it as a fertilizer, but through some caveats they're no longer able to do the duplication through the fertilizer permit. So they are seeking, working with public health and also Chuck Matthews and Department of Ecology to apply for a land use, land application of this on a 160-acre parcel that has properties both in the city and in the county. And so that will be coming forward in the next few months. They're hoping, it's every other year that they do this, so this is the year that they're slated to do the land application. It's something that they've done before, they have a history. But they will need to go through a new solid waste permit because they're not able to go through the other nutrient portion as a fertilizer amendment any longer. So I don't have a lot of the details yet. I don't have a formal application, but that is something that I do hope to bring before the SWAC, perhaps when we meet in March. And there might be, if there's something more pressing that we need more timely, it might be something that we might need a special session or a special meeting or some kind of online voter support or opinions at that point. But I just wanted to give that heads up that that's kind of coming down the pathway.
What's the land application?
It is, again, I don't know.
Is it a field?
It's a field. I'm not sure exactly what they're growing there. I think it is a berry farm. And I'm not exact. I don't have all of the details yet. Those are coming and will be part of the application, as far as what is grown there and how, you know, what's applied and when, and the application rates will all be part of that application that's submitted. But I don't have those kinds of details at this point.
Thanks, Melissa.
Yeah. I had two things. First, I wanted to address a question at the last meeting about email voting, and we did a little research, and we couldn't find any information about why we couldn't do that. Actually, if you've ever heard of SWACs voting by email or not being allowed to do so, it would largely be, you know, things that aren't of high priority where we should. I mean, we would obviously use some discretion to figure out like what would be, because the hope is that there's always an opportunity for public comment and as much transparency as possible. So email voting would usually just be for minor things that we don't necessarily need to actually meet in person for. But we couldn't find anything. But please let me know if you do find something or hear something, and then we can change our bylaws.
You might want to look at the Open Public Meetings Act. It would be the thing that I think would be most relevant.
And then I had a question for SWAC if you wanted your contact information available on the website so that the sectors that you represent are able to contact you directly instead of if they don't feel comfortable contacting the county. So it would be up to you if you want that available. Stephen had brought that up and he was in favor of that, and so I just wanted to ask the rest of SWAC that was something you would be interested in or opposed to, or if all emails should be directed to us and then distributed to you, or however we want to do it.
So you need to say yay or nay individually then, or?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it makes sense for some people to do it or some people not. if that would be, you know, so I feel like it would be everyone should or...
Would it be possible to get like a county email address for us? That way we're not giving out, I personally don't mind giving out my email. Mm-hmm. Others may not. If we could have a county email that we could check into, you know, this person represents this area, and sent to me.
Well, you know, I think what we can do now that we're talking about, because the other thing that we do have specialized emails set up at the county, so maybe we just create a SWAC email and say if you want to contact or you want to send a message to your SWAC representative. I think it would be hard for us to set up individual emails for each of you, not being county employees. Mm-hmm. But we could create an email for folks that want to make a contact the SWAC member, pass along questions, etc., and then review it, give them instructions, like identify where you're from, etc., and then we can forward it to the member.
I think that sounds great.
Yeah, sounds like an appropriate move.
Sure. Yeah, I only have one email. It's my firm.
Because we've done that for other services in the department. So I think that'd be a good solution.
Yeah, it could be swag@clark.wallet.com.
Exactly.
And then I can
put it on the website.
And then within there, they would have all of our areas that we represent.
Yeah, and that's already on there. There's just no contact information associated with those.
I just realized that might be a better way. Okay.
So I have a few updates from our outreach team and myself. So first, I just wanted to say we had a good holiday take-back event January 7th.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a kickoff to Block Phone being now accepted at Central Transfer Station. So during any operating hours, but we highly suggest that people bring Block Phone on weekdays because of all the traffic concerns on the weekend at Central Transfer. So if you do share that, just kind of encourage people to show up on weekdays. But we're accepting all Block Phone for recycling for residents only and businesses, and it's for free.
On weekdays?
I suggest weekdays.
Just at Central Transfer, yes.
Yeah, just because the traffic is really congested on the weekends, and the amount of petroleum and Block Phone isn't very significant, so by the time you're idling to get there, it's kind of questionable if you're actually
doing any good.
So I highly suggest people do it on weekdays. Also, we just added a new paint store for our paint take-back program, and granted that there's still time, I'll kind of go over our paint take-back program. And so I believe that's now 10 locations, so that's great. So also, there's for our green business program, there's a morning blend on the 16th from 8 to 9 a.m. at Boomerang. We're also doing a green awards, which Cindy might know more about that since you're here. Take advantage of that. which is on March 23rd from 5 to 6:30 p.m. at the Kiggins. And the Green Awards is new. You're probably familiar with the Green Business Showcase. So that's now transformed into the Green Awards, which is, you can nominate people to win either a Green Apple Award, which is like a teacher or an educator. There's also Green Large Business and Green Small Business, as well as Product or Service. Green Neighbor Award and Green Volunteer Award. And nominations are due on the 24th of this month.
And so this is the main county website here for those. So go ahead, Cindy. I just wanted to show that to them that there, it is on the county website also.
Is it?
No, you're right. It's the 24th. I was thinking of Wastebusters.
Oh.
Is this starting today? Or I haven't heard anything about this.
Yeah, so I don't know when it was kicked off, but was it? Yeah.
The actual event has not been advertised as such. It's just in the nomination phase right now, so there's some...
Oh, sure, I'm not sure about yet.
What event?
The event day.
Oh, yeah. No, that's fine.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
It's on the 23rd
of March.
So how is the public coming to find out that this A, exists, and B, how to... Is there something in the Columbian?
There will be press releases. And in fact, the Vancouver Business Journal, we have an ad in that, and the North Bank Magazine, and a press release to the Columbian. So there's been send out email listservs and things like that to the groups that, especially the groups that may nominate, like our master composter groups and the schools and that type of things. And then there'll be more publicity about the actual event closer to March.
I know Green Neighbors does a really good job with social media, so that's how I hear a lot of things, being a follower of their site. So it's, I think it's a really good way. And then the next, what is it, Next Door Neighbors, they have a good broad audience. So I think those are really important ways to get the word out. People are relying on that more and more now.
Some other updates, about 30 people are now in their second class for the Master Composter Recycler Program. So we'll have 30 new volunteers that will be trained on composting and recycling and then educate the community. And Wastebusters will be starting in March. You need to sign up for that. Can you speak a little bit?
Well, it starts, Wastebusters starts on the 10th, but you can sign up, make a pledge actually, until the 9th. And that's through our, I think there actually is a URL that you can get through our Green Neighbors website to sign up on Wastebusters. And I'm trying to remember the pledges now. One is to pledge to use a recycled mug or a reusable mug to purchase food wisely, as far as so there's no waste of food. And the other was recycle everything appropriately in the blue recycling cart. Everything that can be recycled in the blue cart. So they sign up, they take a pledge, and then they practice this pledge for 21 days, which is supposedly the time that it takes to create a new habit. And then there's surprises at the end for people to participate and post on social media.
And that is all for me.
Okay, thanks. City of Vancouver, Katya.
I'll go ahead and go to the front of the room so you guys don't have to turn all the way back. Just two quick updates for me today. All right, better?
Yeah,
yes.
Better now.
Good to see you all.
Good
to
see
you people. I'm sorry I missed names. I'll catch up with you afterwards. Again, my name is Tanya Gray. I work for the City of Vancouver in the Garbage and Recycling Department. We are on the other side of fall, and the city heads up the Fall Leaf Coupon Program for the region. Clark County Public Works and City Solid Waste fund the disposal of leaves. We provide leaf coupons to everybody in the community. They can use as many as they'd like. They can pick them up at convenient locations throughout the community, and they can also download them from websites. So at the end of 2016, when the leaf season was over, we ended up collecting 5,457 coupons. So 5,457 were redeemed at four different disposal sites that the city has a contract with. That resulted in about 16,243 cubic yards of leaves. That means they weren't out in our streets clogging up our storm drains, and they weren't in garbage cans. They were deposited at sites for composting. The total cost for that in disposal cost was $120,000. So compared to last year, that's pretty flat. We did about the same in cost and cubic yards as compared to last year. So just an update for information on that for you. Also wanted to let you know, I hope by now all of you have heard about the Recycle Right app, and you've all downloaded it to your smart device. Right?
Yeah.
Right, everyone?
Yes.
So I want to tell you another reason to download it. If you haven't done that yet, you can go to the Google Play Store or the Apple whatever store. What is it? App Store?
Right.
It's just too easy to remember, right? Go there and enter Recycle Right. The Recycle Right app will allow you to check your schedule online, sign up for reminders, and you can also get access to Recycling A to Z. So if you ever have a question about how to dispose of something, you can enter it into that box and gain access to a lot of resources about disposal in our community. Now, when we had snow recently, customers can sign up for severe weather alerts through the app. And so we can actually put in a message as soon as we know what's going on with garbage and recycling and push it out to customers who have signed up for these alerts. In December, we had 8,818 folks in our community that have signed up for such an alert. That's even more than have signed up for regular reminders. So people have gone there and said, well, you know, the reminder's not really for me. I've got this garbage day thing down. I know when it is, but I do want to know if my garbage gets canceled. So they've opted for that. And you can't see this, but I'll just tell you, this chart shows a humongous spike when we had the snow event. So people were going to the app and saying, what's going on with my service? So we know that they're interested and aware of this, and we're going to try and keep honing in on getting that information out in a timely manner. So that's all I have for the update from the city tonight. Thank you.
Question.
Yeah.
Is there a reason people would need to print out multiple coupons if they're making dropping off leaves?
Yes, because each coupon is limited in the load size. We try to make sure that it's a load that maybe a resident would be bringing in so that a business doesn't bring in like a huge trailer full of leaves. So we try to keep it in about the 4 cubic yard range. And that's also a reasonable load for a standard pickup truck. So we don't limit how many times you can come or go, but we do want just to keep it in a reasonable size.
Sure.
Does that make sense?
It does. I was just thinking, why would they be printing out multiple pages for the same purpose? But if it's...
Yeah. Okay. So each load should be about 4 cubic yards.
Sure. Where does the leaves go?
So there's 4 vendors that we work with, and one of our sites is actually West Van, which is operated by Waste Connections, and those are composted out in Scappoose, St. Helens? I think it's St. Helens. They're taken out to Beaver Bark. H&H also composts them out there, and Triangle Resources is another disposal site, and City Bark. I was like, oh, I'm forgetting the last one. So those, City Bark doesn't compost on site, they take them elsewhere to be composted as well. Some of our sites are very limited by size, but convenient for disposal. Anything else?
Thanks, Nate.
Okay, thank you.
Waste Connections.
Okay. Yeah, so I was going to talk about weather, but do I need to defer because Mike had that? Or?
Yeah, go ahead and talk about it because Mike is
here. I'll speak a little bit to that
here
then.
Today.
Yeah, so. Great. Our biggest hurdle over the past couple of months has been a lot of weather-related issues, as you probably have heard about. probably about 2 months ago in December, we started having some on and off weather. The challenge, of course, has been many customers haven't been serviced on their normal service day, and things have had to be postponed. And of course, it all culminated here most recently when we had about 5 days in a row where we actually were not able to get out on the road. Up until that point, we'd have been able to service at least some of the areas throughout the community, but not everything. But here just recently, we actually went 5 days in a row, and I can happily say that about a week ago, we were totally caught up, and everybody's all back to normal and all that kind of thing. I think some of the biggest challenges were here locally in the city with some of the commercial vendors, of course, having just piles and piles of trash. In order for us to get out of that, we actually went out and hired some temporary help, and we brought in people and resources from other of our companies and brought them down to help us get through that cleanup. So it was quite a bit. Just to give you an idea, our normal disposal is around 500,000 or 500 tons a day. We were almost 1,000 tons a day for the first several days trying to clean up out of that mess. So it almost doubled our volume, which is about right. We figure for a week behind, it should be about double, but it's just tough to get it on one day. So just briefly, that was kind of what I wanted to tell you about and let you know that we're back on track, assuming we don't have any real bad weather tonight.
What's your prediction?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm planning on it to be a normal tomorrow, but it's hard to say. We don't know. The storm's supposed to hit later on, so hopefully it won't impact us, but fear is there might be some areas that we can't get to, so we'll make that determination tomorrow. That app will be helpful. If more people get on it, it's really nice to be able to communicate to people that way. So. Yeah. That's it. Any questions for me?
Great. Thanks, Jim.
I called in to find out about my garbage schedule. And I don't know if the call person would have told me to download the app, I probably would have, I don't know, it would have been a good time to tell someone.
Be a good thing to add for our voice when you get in, you're getting the recording, then to tell people, download the app.
Download the app. Right.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah. You can put it out on C3G too. I can put it out on Unfiltered. There's 2,000 people that know about it now.
Right.
Good. Okay, well, thank you. And Peter.
Yes.
Thank you. So I came here this evening to kind of give you an update on something called the Coordinated Prevention Grant. We're going to start a little basic. I don't know if anybody is how familiar you are with that term and what the program's all about. So I'll give you a little history before I kind of launch into the current news. Coordinated Prevention Grant is a grant that was originated in the early 90s, and its singular purpose is to provide money to local government, and specifically counties, with a few exceptions. There's a few cities that get it, but basically counties, and it funds their solid waste implementation and planning and solid waste enforcement. I was talking to Kim before. I think of the solid waste managers and the health department, but I know that with your reorganization, you're sort of a singular organization. But the point is, this is the state's sole funding mechanism to local government to implement a lot of projects. It's not for solid waste disposal. It's not for landfills. It's not for capital projects. It's pretty much from the solid waste planning and implementation side for drafting your plans, updating your plans, and it's for recycling waste reduction programs and moderate waste, hazardous waste. And for the enforcement side, we generally subsidize or help pay for permitting and illegal dumps and complaint code work. I'm sure it's not the only source of money for your county. For some counties, it is the only source, but for yours, I'm sure you have plenty of tipping revenue and other countywide sources of revenue. But it is significant. The state works on a biennial budget. It starts July 1. The next biennial budget will start July 1, 2017, run through June 30, 2019. We afford our grants on that two-year period. The grant itself, the source of the grant is something called the Model Toxics Control Act. This was an initiative passed, I think, in the late 80s by Citizens of Washington, and it essentially places a tax on the importation of hazardous substances. And I think almost the entire revenue stream is made up from oil that comes into Anacortes. And for some of you may have noticed that the cost and the price of oil has gone down dramatically. I think it was trading at $120, $30, $40 a barrel just a couple of years ago, and I think it might be up to $50, but for a couple of years it was down to $40. What this means is that the Model Toxics Control Act is just a fraction of what it used to be, and it grew to the point where it was funding CPG and many other environmental activities in the state of Washington. The governor, by law, produces a budget every December, and that budget is the starting point for the legislature to create their budget. And in that budget, he actually created two budgets, I'll make that clear. The first budget is the one that he creates that he would like to see implemented, but in this case it involved $4.2 billion of additional revenue. Then that's just his thoughts. And out of that budget, he identified $10 million for coordinated prevention grants. For this entire state of Washington. That money would only be generated if the legislature passes a surcharge on the MOTCA tax. So it's the current trading price of oil is so low that it's not even it's actually already set to start the next biennium about $75 billion in the hole. In other words, the state's already got obligations for less than 75 million more than what we expect to come in. So there's currently a bill in front of the legislature that's going to propose a surcharge, which will sort of raise the floor of that MOTCA tax up to, I think, 165 million. And if that happens, if that bill is passed, then there would be $10 million out of that account set aside for local governments. I want to give you a little sense of scale or history for the state and for Clark County. In the early 90s, when the program started, the MOTCA account, I think when it first got going, was about $15 million for the state. And in the 2013 to 15 timeframe, it was up to $28.5 million. Clark County's share of that, there's a formula there, but its basic share was about $1.5 million. Last year, the legislature reduced the MOTCA account, or the CPGM account rather, to $15 million, and so about half. And I think Clark County got around $750,000. And that, again, split between the health department for some of Melissa's work, probably some of Chuck's work, as well as the other side that does implementation and planning. The current budget is $10 million, so you're looking at a one-third reduction from that. So Clark County, if the legislature passes the governor's proposal, which is no sure thing, would get less than $500,000. So these are projects, I was kind of looking at some of your tasks, particularly on the implementation side. Clark's always been rather creative in what their project, you have a number of projects and with pace for pieces of things. But I think it historically has paid for composting and green schools and a number of things in this community. And you probably will end up either having to make some priority choices or scale back some of your projects if you're going to end up relying on CPG for that money. I mentioned before the governor had two budgets. He produced the first one, which is the one he'd like to see, and had a bunch of new revenue involved. The second budget's the one he produces because the Constitution says he has to produce a budget based on projected revenues on existing revenue sources. And in that budget, he also has $10 million, but the difference is the money comes from the state building construction account. And that's problematic too. Bonds are typically associated with capital projects. And by and large, coordinated prevention grants are not capital projects. They pay for operating, they pay for staff, they pay for, kind of onesies. There's not generally a piece of infrastructure or something that's going to sit around for 20 years. And there's some legislative concern that it's not always the best idea to be paying off a bond for 20 years for something that disappeared, doesn't have any durability. So there's a challenge here, and I just came here to share that with you because I'm not really sure, how much you're going to rely on coordinated prevention grants moving forward, but typically most counties it is fairly significant. And you might need to do some rethinking of some of your plans or finding other sources of revenue. I've done this at a few other SWACs, and some of them have chosen to politically become engaged, and I'm not here to advocate for that. I work for the governor, and the governor's budget is my budget, but there's legislative opportunity there if that's something that Clark County SWAC has a thought to do. Another little small detail that does relate to this, and it's a little, I'll get into it, I guess, is that ecology is coincidentally reevaluating or opening up our rule, that regulation that distributes this money to local governments. And there's a number of changes that may or may not happen, and we'll go out with a draft version for counties to review in a couple weeks. But one of the first things that have come up, we divide the money right now, and we have for 15 years, that we've given 80% of it to the implementation side and 20% of it to the enforcement side. But we've reached a point where the pot has gotten so small that I've had a number of my health departments tell me that they can't even keep a solid waste person on board. And so I have at least four different counties that may drop that. And the state doesn't have the ability to go in and look. The Constitution only gives the authorization to the counties to issue solid waste permits. So it's interesting to see what would happen if a county chooses not to do that. One of the things the rule will look at is redefining that distribution between the health departments and implementation. But we'll work collaboratively with the stakeholders to figure out how that'll work out and if that'll really happen. So, but that's a proposal that's on the table. So,
and I can interject. And just for SWAC, especially those who are new to solid waste industry, so there are solid waste enforcement components that we as public health around the state, we do almost for free. There are exempt solid waste facilities, so all of our recycling facilities, City Dark that accepts yard debris for the community, accepts scrap metal, our IMS who accepts recycling for our community, those are all exempt recycling facilities. We receive $0 for their permitting. However, we still receive an application for them. We help work with them as a liaison to go through the community development piece so that they can be an approved solid waste facility so that they can provide that service to our citizens. There is no fee that they pay us annually, but they are required to submit annual reports to ecology and public health so that we can track how much is being recycled and so that we can do the right thing. But there is no
monetary fee that we receive. I do annual inspections at the facilities. If there's any complaints or if they have questions or inquiries throughout the year, I work with them and provide technical assistance, as does Ecology helps us with that too. So there are activities that aren't necessarily covered under the solid waste permit fees for the limited facilities that we have. Additionally, the CPG grant is a match grant. So we match 25% of the monies that we get from Ecology. So the permit fees that we get from our solid waste facilities are really important that we maintain enough funds for the permit so that we are able to match the funds that we get from Ecology. And as you know, landfills, our close landfills like Hallstrom, Roofner, Circle C, they're all in that termination of post-closure where we're not getting those permit fees any longer. So that decreases the amount that we're able to then match and request funds from Ecology. So those are, I think, important components of the CPG that as SWAC members for you to consider and kind of keep in mind.
Is it pretty normal for those on permitting facilities or the exempt facilities to not have fees associated with it? Or?
It is pretty common around the state that they not have fees just because it's exempt from permit by rule. There are some counties that have implemented nominal fees for them. One is kind of a one-time upfront fee for when you become a new facility, and then they have kind of an annual fee that I would assume to probably estimate how many hours that you're spending at the facility and to write the reports and do all of that. And at this time, we don't have that kind of fee structure.
The other thing I would just add is, obviously, as you might expect, we'll be following this as closely as we can. Well, we're really following it closely, and we're already, Cindy and I and our financial person are talking about, you obviously have to make assumptions in of the reduction, et cetera. So we're already looking at how does that work with the budget and the other revenue that comes into the solid waste program. So we'll keep an eye on it and update SWAC at some point if there's decisions made about programs, et cetera.
How big of a, with the decommissioned landfills, what are the permit fees that are coming from that?
The permit fees for a closed landfill, I believe, is currently $4,300 a year. For Leichner Landfill, which was a municipal solid waste landfill, I believe theirs is $8,000 off the top of
that. That sounds so good.
So we do have Hallstrom, Roofner, and Circle C were special waste or limited purpose landfills, and so they didn't accept municipal solid waste, so their fees are less than the current structure.
I didn't catch those acronyms you're using for the funding source for the
Model Toxic Control Act.
MOTC.
Yeah.
CPG is coordinated
prevention grant, which we're looking at changing that name because it doesn't make any sense to anybody. But
it sounds like utility CPG.
Yeah.
What's a preferred name?
Well, it's early, but I think we're going to go out with a proposal of a local solid waste financial assistance program. A mouthful, but
that's a lot.
We have a challenge where when we go to the legislature every year and we're asking for these funds, and the 100% of the funds go to local government, and this has been going on for 12, 13 biennia, that they, what we say, coordinated prevention grant, and it's like showing a dog a card trick. They don't know what that means. And so we decided we were going to try to resolve that by, even if it takes a lot of words, we'll put a name in there that I think anyone would go, oh, okay, I understand what that is. So
that might work, actually, that dog.
Any other discussion on that?
Well, I guess one, what's the time frame for the advocating for the surcharge?
Well, there's a hearing next week. So, there's that's something that'll happen. But it's in a committee meeting, I think, or hearing, I'm not really sure. So that occurs next week. You can look on the Washington State Legislature hearings page. And but, you know, if the SWAC chooses to write a letter or work with their county commissioners to write a letter in support, just contact your local legislators and let them know that this is important or not to you. And I think it matters. There's very pressing issues going on in Olympia right now. And although it's very important to me and some of you, this one, probably relative to what they have to work on, this isn't the top of their list. So, and that doesn't mean they're not willing to vote a certain way. It just means that they have to make sure that they understand the importance of it. So next week there's a hearing on that particular referendum. Bill.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
The roll liability release. Who's going to take lead on that? Steve's not here.
Well, a resident of Steve in Steve Wilson's area, Chris Roberty. And I think some information, background regarding the difficulties and the letter that came to them regarding the ability of solid waste trucks to go down a private road. Chris is here tonight just, I guess, to give us an overview of the situation. I think it was the letter was sent out to folks too. So you had that available when I put it up. And so Chris, if you wanted to say a few things about the situation.
Sure. Is that all right? I sit back here?
Sure, yeah.
I can see you have a packed agenda tonight, so I won't take up too much time here. But I'll start off by saying I'm a lifelong recycler, so I'd love to see weekly recycling, if that's ever a discussion I know. The blue cart twice a week drives me nuts, once every 2 weeks. So so originally I contacted Steve Willis to find a solution to an issue that had come to the residents of the road that I live on and three other private roads that are adjacent, so it affected about 48 total people. And I contacted this committee to basically provide information and solicit advice. The problem may have resolved itself for the most part about 2 days ago. But basically, I live on a private road. We have garbage service on our road. There's 48 total people on this private road. And we received a letter from Waste Connections at the end of December requesting them to sign a liability release for any damage to our road caused by the garbage trucks. In and of itself, I understand that. I'm a local civil engineer. I design roads. I get the issue at its core. For me, the issue was the letter also stated that if we didn't sign the release, then our garbage pickup point would be moved half a mile to three quarters of a mile down the road at one spot, which meant 48 people would be hauling their recycle bins, their garbage, and their glass bins to set them on this 15-foot wide road, and that wasn't acceptable to me. So we've worked to not get into the details of that. Waste Connections has been very professional. I've talked to three or four people at their firm, and apparently everybody has signed this release, which is a shock to me. So kudos to them to get that done. I should have had them involved when I tried to get the road paved a couple years ago. So that's kind of resolved the issue, but I guess what I wanted to do is kind of go through a couple quick points of why the release still kind of bothers me, and maybe lessons learned for the next time this type of an issue comes up, knowing that I'm not expecting a resolution or a decision or any advice at this point. It's just kind of for discussion's sake. So kind of the first thing was that we all live on this road. We all have an easement and a maintenance agreement that's in our deed that's recorded. And so everybody has right of access over, under, and across these roads. So mail, fire, police, school bus, everybody uses the roads, and nobody needs an additional release. Having said that, obviously,
Public too?
Anybody? Yes.
Anybody
can go on the roads. There's no signage, there's no deed, there's nothing like that. Obviously, garbage trucks are special because they're extremely heavy and they have the most potential to damage the road. But the maintenance agreement specifies it's our responsibility to maintain it. So signing a release that duplicates an existing deeded and recorded responsibility to me seems a little bit duplicitous, so it scares me as to what that means for the future. if they decided to go to, you know, twice, let's say they make their garbage truck smaller because it's more fuel efficient, and they go to twice a week delivery, and so we get twice as many trucks, are we still liable to things that the road wasn't designed for necessarily? So so that's concern is what it is. It goes away, garbage service continues, and that's really my primary desire. But for future, just try and remember this is essentially the same as a monopoly, because the consumer need doesn't have any other option for garbage service. So when a letter is provided that says, do this or else we're going to cut your garbage service off, it causes a lot of undue stress. It took me about 2 years to get all my 25 neighbors on the same page to repave the road, and I got three of them that never talked to me. They wouldn't ever even speak with me. And so I was shocked when he got all these releases. That's great, but I thought that task was going to fall on me, which was stressing me out. So, and I would recommend putting at least one contact on the website. It took me quite a while. I had to basically research Steve Willis, find out where he worked, contact him at work, because I didn't know who to call or how to contact anybody. I could see who the representatives are, but I couldn't. There weren't any phone numbers or emails or anything like that. So I would recommend at least having that single email address that we're fine. Yeah. So anyway, those are my concerns, but it's mostly been resolved, and I appreciate you putting on the agenda.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add, you know, of course, I'm new to it, but Mike, I know Mike, who couldn't be here tonight, these situations have come up in the past, and there are some, under the contracts for recycling, there are conditions and ways to work through the resolution through the department, but generally, you know, what we wanted to talk to was that in the past, the county has decided, and one is we always hope and encourage the parties to find a way to resolve it. Secondly, that we've been advised, and we're trying to get additional feedback from our risk management folks, but we've been advised that if the county were to overrule and through the contract try to force the haulers to travel on those types of roads without the liability waiver, then the county becomes at risk potentially. So it's good that it's been raised again, and it's given us a chance to reevaluate, you know, just be go back and look at these issues again. I think we've had some similar issues around access and the difficulty of access in some situations. And so I don't know if we'll have time for it this year, but the other thing we talked about is developing a way through land, you know, the county community development department, when plats are divided and things like that. Is there a path where we could also add some language and some requirements to provide sufficient this is a little different than the issue we talked about, but we've had situations where we're getting complaints and problems where the trucks can't get back to certain areas, and so there's not enough room for them to get back there, and then all the cans get collected in one big area. So those types of things I think we'll try to look at in the coming year or two to see what other things we could do on the planning side of things in the county.
No, I understand that. That's kind of my daily work is involved in community development and site development, thing like that. So yeah. I work with that side of things, making sure the turning movements are available and hammerheads. And so when we pave our road, there's a hammerhead at the end. And, I guess it's probably just a point of clarification. You know, our road is whatever it was when it was designed in 1970, and we paved it in 2012. But there are gravel roads, there are super old roads, there are brand new private roads, there's all sorts of the gamut of roads. Going after private road owners saying we have an ability to cut your service off because your road is substandard to our understanding of what our trucks need, versus, you know, half the roads in Vancouver could be labeled less able to sustain a fire or a garbage truck than the road that I live on. You know, if you've been down anywhere in B Street, U Street, anywhere around here, middle way off Highway 14, some roads are in bad shape. So there's probably other ways to do it other than threatening to cut off garbage service, I guess is my point. So,
Chris, I want to thank you for taking the time being here, and I know that this has caused some concern. I personally know people that are involved and live on that
I was very concerned about the elderly as well, so I'm glad your Waste Connections was able to come together and get this result. Thank you.
And like I said, I want to reiterate Jeff and Aaron and Doug. I talked to multiple people and they were all very professional. They called me right back, so it makes it a lot easier to solve problems when people talk with you. I can tell you that. So
it's funny how that works.
Yeah.
Jeff, did you have anything?
Well, I thought if you'd like, I can give you a brief history of how that comes about and what that looks like. That would help. So to start with, you're right. Contractually, there's some things about private road access and liability and that type of thing, and it gives it a lot of leeway to the waste hauler to do that. With that said, there's hundreds and hundreds of private roads throughout the area that we come across on a regular basis. Historically, garbage trucks were much lighter, and going down roads was not as big of a deal as it is today, but typically our trucks are over 50,000 pounds if they're fully loaded, and you know, we never know what the weight is until you finalize your route, of course, but they can go up to 50,000 pounds, so they get pretty significant. What typically happens is we go down a private road, and for years and years we've been doing it, not necessarily knowing it was private or perhaps, you know, one way or the other. And how it typically comes up, and in this case too, Chris, what took place is a neighbor complained because we had a turnaround point that they didn't want us to access anymore on the street. So what we do is they call in and say, don't let your truck down here. What's going on? So we send out a supervisor and they go inspect and find out what's going on and talk to the neighbor. And one of the little side streets that have three houses on it actually said, well, we don't want you down here anymore unless you're going to, you know, be responsible. So that's how this all started. And of course, what we determined is in order to get to their road, it was right in the area where all your houses are as well. So we ended up with all of these homes in this area from one person that complained about the access that we had to suddenly figure out, well, how in the world are we going to get down here and be able to service these customers. So we basically have two options. Either we're allowed to come down and service like we have been historically, or we have to go to the nearest point where we can actually travel to, which I guess is about half a mile away from what you stated. You know, so it kind of puts us in a situation where we're forced to do something. So in this case, we talked to those three neighbors and then got a hold of everybody else's where you got involved. And we sent out the release of liability agreement that basically states if you can sign here, then we can continue to service the same way. And if you're unwilling to sign, then we'll be happy to pick it up at another location as convenient as possible that we can access. But it has to be a place where we can get our trucks to turn around from, and of course, being safe and making sure there's a good turnaround point. In this case, which happens, and I would say the majority of them, most of the residents didn't have an issue signing the form. The liability release is for obvious reasons. We have a heavy truck. We don't know how the private roads are built. You know, it's not like a regular county or city road that's built. They could be done very, very well like yours is. We don't really know that. And there's so many opportunities for problems on those roads. If something were to happen or some damage were to come up, then the question is, was it a garbage truck or was it a UPS truck or what was the culmination of things? We don't know. And so we're basically looking to make sure that everybody's protected and looking for that release form to take care of us. So it's kind of a very brief way of how we get to that point. Our hope is that they come up and they're very easy to manage and maintain, because frankly it'd be easier for us if we just went out and could service everything and didn't even have to go through the process. But you know, with the way things are, we need to be very careful about that and protect ourselves and protect the community. Now that of course doesn't take away anything if we were to cause damage to another vehicle or something, that kind of thing. That's a completely different matter. This is just liability for the road is all that comes down to. Now I will say, if the letter was a little strong, I'd be happy to go back and look at it, because we don't want to come across in a harsh tone or seem like we're forcing people to do something. That's really not the intent. I mean, at the end of the day, it has to be either accessible, or if we can't get access and we have to put it in a different place. But there's obviously a way to soften that up and not make it sound so, you know, harsh if that's the way it came across. So, that's an easy thing to look at. But anyway, that's a basic rundown of what it is. If anybody has any questions about it, I'd be happy to answer that. That's basically how it comes to that.
Jeff, I wonder, he mentioned that a lot of those homeowners already have an existing agreement as part of their deed. Would something like that maybe be something that could be put in the letter as, if you've got something like that, let us know?
Well, actually, so Chris actually sent me the agreement that I looked at, and I personally, I looked at it and thought, well, I'm not sure it really gives us access, but it might. There might be some room for something here. It talked about utilities, without saying what that meant. could go over, under, or I think it was next to the road, something to that effect, across, yeah, something like that. So it wasn't really clear. In fact, I read it, and it wasn't clear that even an emergency vehicle could get access to the road the way I read it. But I sent it off to an attorney and said, hey, take a look, tell me what you think. His response was, well, it's kind of a gray area. You could potentially be okay, and perhaps you're not. It really depends on how you want it. He said, what answer do you want me to give you? You know, and I said, well, okay, thanks for nothing, right? So we went ahead and pursued it the way we did, and it turned out great. And like I said, in most cases, it typically works out this way, but we never know until we get to it. But in this case, I think we only had everybody, but there's two more houses, one who's out of the area, who we're pretty confident will sign the letter and come back, and one that's on vacation. We don't see any problem with. So we're there. What we like to do, by the way, is deal with an HOA if it's available, because that's a lot easier to deal with one entity versus, in this case, 50.
Well, again, Chris, actually. Okay, Green Schools program presentation. Michelle.
You can take a regular video. Special computer.
All right, well, while they're getting that together, again, I'm Michelle Pasinich, and I've worked for the county for about a year and a half now, and I lead our Green Schools program. One of the great recipients of the CPG grant. So. And I've been with the county for about a year and a half, and I've been leading the Green Schools program just since July. So haven't been quite through a full school year of it yet. But what I want to do is give you an overview of kind of what the program entails. I know when I first stepped into this role in July, I felt a little bit overwhelmed. Like, there were just so many pieces and so many random things that we did. And one of my goals was to just really shore that up and be able to easily explain to people what kind of services that we provide. So, because some people think of Clark County Green Schools as Washington Green Schools, and some people think of it as composting, and it's all of that and many other things. So, go ahead. But one of the key things for my job, and one of the things that I love the most about it, is just partners. So we work so much with our different partners. So. The county works with Washington Green Schools, Waste Connections, the City of Vancouver, and also our local school districts. And together we provide education and technical support to all schools, public and private. I know there's kind of some misconceptions that we only support public schools, but we really, the goal of our department is to reduce waste in Clark County, and that can be served in public and private schools. So one of the big things that we do is waste reduction, education, and outreach, and we'll get into that a little bit more later. I work in close partnership with Ellen Ives from Waste Connections. We also provide composting and recycling training and education, and also supplies and equipment. One role that I've kind of found myself in lately is waste reduction advocacy and food recovery, kind of moving in some of those directions as well, because I think, you know, composting is great, but we'd love to have the food feed the people before that. And we provide a connection for schools to the certification program that Washington Green Schools provides. And so our composting program, we have, when I took this job on, I met with Greg Hayward, which used to work for Waste Connections, and he said, I want you to know, you have one of the most robust composting programs around in schools. So just know that, which was great, because I talked to some people from some other places, and they're like, you have how many schools composting? So it's pretty exciting to go to these different schools and see how proficient these students are. So I have I think the next slide shows a sort table. We have these sort tables where students can dump out their milk, recycle their container, their carton or juice box, put their trash in it, and then all their food goes into the food waste cart. So the county, through our CPG grant and other funding sources, we provide these sort tables. We contract through a local contractor that builds these for us. We provide signage, and we provide little nifty nappers that can pull out contaminants out of the food waste carts. So if a school is interested in implementing that, then we kind of take them from beginning to end. We just rolled it out at Pleasant Valley Primary. That was a school that was previously 100% of their lunch was going into the trash. They weren't even recycling milk cartons. And so we intervened with them and set up a composting program. We went, Ellen and myself, and then kind of also on my team is we have an AmeriCorps that's with us for a 6-month term, and then also Han Marino, one of our techs. So we have our nice Green Schools team, which is nice because a couple months ago it was just Ellen and I, and we were feeling a little bit overwhelmed, so it's nice to have help. But we rolled out the composting table. We went to every grade level, and Ellen and Ben presented a waste reduction lesson, kind of the how and why. So we hit every grade level, and then we were there on site to train them for a full week. And we felt like that really gave them just a good solid start. And not just saying, you have to do this, but the why. Waste audits revealed that at least 30% of garbage is food waste, and we certainly want to harness that and turn it into something productive. So we have at least 75 schools in Clark County, and there really is a passion right now. I said to our Rob Marchand, who builds our sort tables, I'm like, I need some more, because there's just, we did a massive waste audit at the Green Schools Summit, and I had so many people saying, we need to bring this back. And there was a time when paper was accepted in compost in schools, and then that was changed. And so some of the schools really struggled with that change and abandoned the program. But we're seeing some people coming back to that now. And as I've said to Ellen and some other people, I said, you know, I think it's good that they stopped, because sometimes it's easier to introduce something fresh and new versus kind of weather through that change. And some people kind of couldn't weather through that change of not being able to take napkins and paper boats and all of that. So we take food only in our food waste carts. And then last school year, we kept 820 tons of organic materials out of the landfills. And it's picked up by Waste Connections, a separate route from everything else, and then hauled to Dirt Hugger in the Dalles. And it takes about 90 days to turn it from food waste into rich compost. Right. So here's a picture of our sort tables. This is actually at Pleasant Valley, so just happy students. So the white bucket there, we try to keep everything color-coded, so it's really simple for them. So that holds the liquids, then the containers, garbage, and then food waste there at the end, and that gal at the end is holding the little napkin. One thing we really try to instill is this is a whole school-wide ethic. I know Ellen will say, whose job is it to take care of the waste, you know, after you're done with it? And they're like, you know, Jeff, our custodian. And she's like, no, whose job is it? It's all of our jobs to take care and be responsible for our food waste. It's not the lunch monitor. So really instilling that personal responsibility of them doing it and doing it properly. So I just went there yesterday to check in on them, and we took some more pictures, and they were doing great. So it's good to see with proper education, something like that can be well accepted.
How many schools is it again?
75, about 75. We were at 75, we're adding some. So we have, I think it's 136 public schools. And so it's over 100, if you count all the privates, it's over 150 schools that we manage.
In where?
In Clark County. Wow. So no wonder Ellen and I were overwhelmed. So that's oh my gosh, this is so many schools, and people just have so many needs and so many levels. So one thing that we're kicking off right now is our annual visits. So we're trying to reach every school in the county, which with our team of four, and then some of our other partners with the city and other people in the department, we go and just assess where are they at, are they composting, what are the needs that they have, do they need a new strainer for their bucket, do they need education? So that really gives us kind of the intel for what we need to do next and where intervention is needed. I personally love to work at the district level and love to be in the schools too, but I found through other people's mistakes too, you need to start up here and make sure that everybody has buy-in. And then it's so much easier to implement. And one thing too, you know, we work really strongly with Vancouver School District and really strongly with Evergreen. Part of that is because they have people really dedicated towards conservation and reproduction. But one of my goals too, it was kind of with the over 150 schools, it's like, how do we allocate our attention? But, I feel like we do a good job of really maintaining those districts, but I'm really trying to reach out. I've been really trying to reach out to Battleground. I love to meet with the different district representatives. There were some changes in Camas. We went out and met with the new people there. And I want to reach out to Hawkinson and just make sure that those other districts that maybe aren't participating as much in our programs really know what we have to offer, because we really have a lot to help them with. All right. Picture of the rich compost. All right. So just to talk about numbers, we talked about some of these a little bit. So 75 schools plus a few more participate in the composting program. 820 tons of food waste diverted from landfills and turned into compost, and over 42,000 cubic yards per year of recyclables were kept out of landfills from schools. And so one thing we try to do too is just, provide as much service for them as possible. I know Beth and Ellen and I worked on this classroom recycling guide. We try to, as I say, keep up with the current trends of kid garbage. So I have four kids myself. So, you see what's coming through, the applesauce pouches and the pudding cups and all the different kinds of things. So we try to picture, we can pass this around, just try to make it really easy, and our sort table signs also provide pictures, so it's easy for them to see what is recyclable, what's garbage, and it gets confusing. We all just kind of have to say, I know it's confusing. You can recycle your yogurt container, but you can't recycle your pudding cup, but at least we try to picture those differences there. All right, next. So one area that I said that I'm just passionate about lately is, and I've dubbed it my food reduction advocacy, or waste reduction advocacy work. We have seen a trend in an increase in disposables. And it's in our largest school district, Evergreen. Many of our districts, I feel like, do a really good job of doing things with the least waste possible. But Evergreen is just taking a different turn, and Ellen and I was just at their resource conservation meeting where it's all the green team leaders, and we at those meetings specifically, plus our own observations, have seen, oh my gosh, why are we serving carrots in plastic bags and celery in plastic bags and putting syrup in little containers, whereas other places we see it's in a pitcher, and you can take with tongs if you want two carrots or four carrots. And so this was just at an elementary school just last week. But our approach was, we're here to help you, and let's kind of figure out what's happening here and how can we kind of turn this train around, because I know that they care strongly about conservation, and so myself and Ellen and Dave Cohn, the resource conservation manager, met with some district heads last week and just kind of expressed our concerns and what are some things that we can do, and can we get your support, and through our connection with a few other ladies that work in schools and public health, we have a meeting next week with the nutrition services manager, so we're hoping. I think they were a little bit surprised at how many pieces of garbage were produced for lunch. And it's concerning, too, to see a tray, which is actually kind of rare in some schools to even see trays. Some of them were disappearing, plastic trays. But why do we have to put a paper bow on a plastic tray? And so that is something that we are really working on and getting good support. And actually, at another meeting with another group of teachers at Evergreen, the director of Chartwell's Food Service was there, and he said in front of an open crowd that he was willing to, because one school worked with them to bring back real forks. They were super happy about it and passionate, and trays, and he said that he was willing to do that with any school that wanted to do the education work, and they were happy to do that, because it involves them then paying people to wash the trays or wash the silverware. So it was, I wrote it down as he was saying it. I will buy forks for whoever, whatever school wants them. So it was a big victory.
Who's Chartwell's again?
Chartwell's is food service company that Evergreen School District employs. And I believe that they're in Hopkinson as well, too.
So in the center.
At the center, okay. So, and I don't know if the, if what their service is the same for all, you know, they're national. So, but there's other, you know, Sodexo is in Battleground and other districts, and it doesn't, it's just delivered differently. So.
I missed the lunch lady with the sprayer on the tray.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. So, but it's been fun. One thing that I love about my job too is to be able to partner with these students and green team leaders and schools to, like, this is their chance to really advocate for change in their own school. Like Mill Plain Elementary, the ones that brought back this, the forks. This teacher was working over the summer, you know, emails back and forth with the district and food service and making a video, and these kids, they were so happy to be able to make a change, and that's just great to see. All right. So another big piece of what we do is we work with Washington Green Schools. So they're a statewide nonprofit. They're up in Seattle, and they have created an environmental certification process. So schools can certify in any of these six areas. Allie is an amazing green team leader at Camas High School. And how many categories have you guys?
Just one.
Just one. Seems like so many more. Waste and recycling. Yeah. So one thing that I love too, you know, certainly we're funded, but you know, we're part of the solid waste team, but schools really have choice in what they want to certify in. I feel like the resources that I have to provide for them, I give them a lot of tools if they want to certify in waste and recycling, like waste audits and education, and we bring in Will Horniak, a storyteller. I have a lot to support them in that, but I really, if they're passionate about fixing up the creek behind their school or saving energy, then I try to connect them to Clark Public Utilities or Jane and Clean Water, and here's a place where you could get a grant to do a certain project. So, and now with our being in public health, that help you school buildings, there's a lot of good opportunities there. And so I mean, some of the ladies in that department to see what other kinds of creative things we can come up with in that. So last school year, we had 29 schools certify in one or more categories. We had several, handful, at least two schools certify in more. It's kind of funny when they get into it. Like, we're going to do all of them, which is great. So we've had 52 schools certify since the program began, and then there's 83 that are active or have registered into the program. And I feel like my role, that was one of the things I was trying to figure out when I first started my job too. Where, if they work with them, what do I do? And I feel like I'm kind of that connector. I'm the salesperson, the marketer, the here, let me come and talk to you about what we do. I'm your local person to get them involved, and then I work on lots of the events as well. Okay.
Next.
Yep. Okay. So Clark County has the most certified Washington Green Schools in any county in the state, which is pretty amazing. And the I'm sure for those of you that have been on this for a long time know that. Some of the folks within the county were part of creating that program, which I think is why they're such great. But I think the county backing of the program, the county's support of the program really contributes to that success. So one of the things through Washington Green Schools that we do together, we put on the Green Schools Summit. The last one we had was November 3rd. It was at Clark College. That was a new venue for us. We were outgrowing the Water Resource Center, which was a great problem to have, having lots of people that wanted to come. So it was turned out to be a great venue for us. So we had information sessions. We did, one of the highlights was the massive waste audit. So I asked Pleasant Valley Primary, who that was the school that we just rolled out composting at. I had asked them, when Ellen and I were debating, what waste should we audit? And they said, oh, let's do the college. I said, no, we need school garbage. We need school kid garbage. And I said, we need to pick a place that's not doing good. So let's do that. So we had, I think it was 240 pounds where Ellen went and picked up in the truck. So we had 240 pounds of waste that we had all these students go through this session. And I think about three or more high schoolers told me they were about to throw up. But it was only a high school problem. I think it was but that was a great aha moment. That's when I had, I think, Fort and Skyview both come up to me and say, we have to bring back composting, you know, will you help us? So we're in process with them. So it was a great thing for them to see this is how it can be, or this is what should be recycled or composted, and everything's just going in the garbage. So let's see. So then we also had a session on solar energy and a few others with the Washington Green Schools team working on how to certify. So it's just a great day where the schools come, the green team leader and up to four students, and we pay for their sub reimbursement and transportation reimbursement. So it's a great, I think there's some pictures on the next slide. It's just a great day of learning. So there's a solar car. That's a little girl in her school uniform from Our Lady of Lourdes. They've really jumped on board, and we've been helping them a lot this year too. So it's great to see a private school in there. So a few from the waste audit. There's Melissa Zerbola, the one that brought back the real forks with her green team, and some more with the solar car. Okay. So that kind of sums up a lot of what we do. There's many other pieces. I guess I did talk a bit about Ellen's piece. So Ellen will teach waste reduction lessons. She has a landfill model. She does a recycle relay. We do the waste audits, which I was at. I had to change my clothes. I was at the Alki Middle School waste audit a little bit earlier. But there's just so many things that we provide for schools, and it's really a team effort. So we're happy to have your support, and hopefully the legislature will find some way to keep the CPG grant going. So, any questions?
That's excellent.
Amazing.
Thank you.
That's good stuff.
Yeah, good. Very good.
It's a great program.
Yeah. Thanks, Michelle.
Yeah, thank you.
I guess on the compost.
Yeah.
Is it kind of free that we give them the compost, or they buy it from us?
It's a service that they pay for, so, and I'm not sure what the charge is, but they get up to 5 carts for that fee, and then if they wanted additional carts, there's not an additional fee. So it is an added charge to their garbage, but the belief is that you will reduce your garbage bill by adding compost. So it's, the goal is to have it be a wash, and so I don't know. I've heard some feedback from Vancouver School District that they feel like it's, especially since they took out paper, that it was costing them more just because then they had to put all that paper towels and everything else and paper boats and all of that in garbage. But that's the belief. And really most districts get behind it. When I met with Battleground, who had not very many schools participating and lots that had pulled out, they were saying, absolutely, all our schools should be doing this. So it's just that implementation and education. You can't just put out carts and it magically happens.
I have a question. Is there any pushback from the custodian staff? Is there an extra step?
You know, that's a good, so Pleasant Valley, our little test case, it's, so my philosophy is we have to bring everybody to the table and bring everybody on board. And when you walk in a school, you realize, you know, you hear grumbling custodian. You're going to make more work for me. And so that was happening there. But I just really included him and just said, you know, included him in the why. And, you know, this is going to make it easier. This is not all on you. That's one of the things that we really emphasize is it's not just your job. It's everybody's job. So I need my quotes from Dusty. I need to pull it. But it was so fun to be there in that school. By the end of the week, he, like, had a swing and a step. He's like, my bags are so light, and there's not liquids dripping out, and, you know, they're not disgusting, and he was super appreciative of all, but we really stepped in to really help, rather than just, here you go, it works out, and he, what was his other, one other big, oh, he was kind of in a little competition, it was exciting to him, he's like, I used to have to dump this, like, 3 times during lunch, and, you know, he's like, I think I can just dump it once. So it was pretty amazing. So, yeah. So I was just at the waste audit at Alki. So we were, so yeah, about 700 students, and they compost. They sort beautifully. He had, so 2 standard waste cans, and they were only about a half full. So that was, so with a school that's really doing well, so it's basically one 32-gallon garbage for 700 students.
Wow.
It's pretty amazing. So,
that's excellent.
Yeah. Yeah. Any other questions?
Okay.
Great. Thanks.
Okay, Melissa, Circle C.
We'll try to be very quick. So, we met last week with our counselors at a workshop talking about Circle C, which is one of our closed landfills. They are still under permit, so it's called a post-closure permit. They closed their doors in 1990, so it's been 27 years for them, and they would like to terminate their post-closure permit. And so what that would mean is that they would no longer have a solid waste handling permit from public health. They wouldn't go out there quarterly. They would no longer do monitoring or maintenance of the landfill itself. So we presented to our council members, gave them a little bit of history of our 8-acre limited purpose landfill that is unlined. And we've been working to put forth a draft set of criteria for them, which was presented to SWAC and approved to move forward in September. So we've presented that through the process. The Board of Counselors would like us to have a public comment period, which we already had planned. Our hope is to gather the items that the public may want to review during that process and develop a staff, kind of just a staff summary to put out to the public. Our proposal is to put that out to the Columbian, the Reflector, make that available at the City of La Center, and also here with Public Health. We're hoping, I've already reached out to their hydrologist who puts together their annual reports and requested some PDF versions of their quarterly report. So he's working to gather that data for us. Ours are all nice and spiral bound, and they didn't want to have to take all of our spiral banking out of ours. So so he's going to do that effort for us to help expedite. We hope to have that completed by the end of February. And allow public comment for the month of March. Our Board of Counselors would like for the actual formal public comment, if they wanted to have a public meeting, to be before the Board of Counselors. And so I think initially we had kind of thought that it would be in this kind of a format, but they had requested it be there. So once that meeting is held, we'll notify you if you'd like to attend that. So that you can hear any comments from the public at that point. We're hoping to end the public comment period by the 1st of April, and then gather all of the comments, if any, and formulate those into that draft criteria that was presented, and present that in the month of April to our, would it be the Board of Health that we would present? It's the same group, but they have different hats. So I believe it's the Board of Health that would then vote to approve finalization of that criteria with Dr. Melnick, our health officer. And then we would present that to the Carlsons to move forward if they elect to do so. So it would kind of be our final packet. So our hope is going through all of this through due diligence and open process and having the public involvement. If they elect not to go through this process, that hopefully a potential future developer or future buyer of the property or someone can pick that up in 6 months or 5 years, and we've already gone through that whole public comment piece and public process. That these are the criteria and they wouldn't change at that point. So that's me. Is that a good summary?
Yeah, I think, you know, so the SWAC historically has been involved and seen how we walk this through, and it is, it's, we haven't heard of many landfills that have actually done this. So, and I think we're trying to be responsive and and come up with this criteria. And the way, just a couple of quick things. So one is the devil's in the details. So we're working with the county attorney's office to make sure that we're very clear on what the steps are, that it's all, you know, and how we work with the board, so that once we get to that place where we can say this is a final criteria, then the current owners, future owners, whoever wants to finish the analysis work, and basically I threw the criteria up. I don't know if this was the late, very latest, but to address these issues, the primary ones in the short term are groundwater. You know, is groundwater continue to be impacted, and is gas production? These are the kind of measurements. Gas production, and then there are other controls, to go, and then leachate production and its impact on groundwater. But then ultimately, there are still some degree of due care that's required, as far as that there is a cap. And so whoever, the current and future owners, should make sure that cap stays in place. So those kinds of things. So anyway, Melissa did a great job with the board. I think they're supportive of it, but we've got to make sure we go through the public process so that when we get to that final criteria, no one says, hey, wait a minute, I didn't hear about this. I'm worried about my groundwater. But anyway, so I think we're in a very good place. So this has been good work by Melissa and some other staff that have helped us move this forward.
Great, thanks. Any questions or comments? Okay, well, thank you. Let's see, weather-related service delay update.
I think we covered that
pretty well.
Yeah.
Okay.
We could have, if we had more time, we could have Jana talk about some of the calls she got, but what was the biggest scale?
Yeah, we don't have time for that. Okay, how about the proposed solid waste legislation, please?
So I'd like to propose, because we're getting short on time, Kim finish her presentation, and some of the things she'll talk to, we might lead into that.
Okay.
If we have time. So I'd like to turn it over to her for now.
Absolutely,
that's okay.
Sure.
Oh, sure, I can do that, yeah. My slide advancing skills have improved during the evening. Well, yeah, we already did that, but can you see from this side? Looks like it's coming. There we go.
Okay, so I was asked to do a presentation a few months ago, I guess, yeah, December 1st, for the Washington State Recycling Association for their Washington Recycles Every Day event that they held in Vancouver. And the focus of that event that they had was on paint recycling, and one of the proposal, or one of the which we'll get into for the legislative updates, but one of the bills that's in currently in, I believe, in committee now, is a paint stewardship bill, also known as paint care, and which is what it is over in Oregon. And so I'll get into that a little bit, but I want to just kind of go over my presentation. I was supposed to talk about the paint take back program at our last meeting, and we decided to wait until I did this presentation, since I was putting it together anyways, and then present it today to talk about paint take back program, which is another CPG funded program that we do. So again, hopefully CPG is good, and so this is another program that it funds. So I'm going to kind of skip over some stuff because we're going to talk about, because it was a presentation to everybody in Washington State. But the question that they had of me was if Clark County was a model for paint recycling in Washington, because we're the only county that recycles our latex paint that I'm aware of. And So that was a big question, because the question is, well, if Clark County does it, is it something that can be implemented at other counties throughout the state? So I talked a little bit about Clark County, just because not everyone was aware of Clark County. But I won't do that today, because I think you guys are pretty familiar with Clark County. So, and then I'll briefly kind of go over paint recycling in general. So, including our paint take-back program. So there's three points of collection for paint, or there were. Our first point was our mobile collections or the recycling day events. We stopped collecting paint at our recycling day events last year, or this year, 2016, we're in 2017 now. And so our second point of getting paint from people is our paint take-back program, which I'll be talking about. And the third point is our transfer stations at the household hazardous waste facilities. People can drop off paint, and the latex paint will be recycled, and the oil-based paint will be repurposed. So these were the numbers from 2015. I don't quite have all the 2016 numbers yet. I'll get those soon, though. These are in pounds, but this is the amount of paint that was collected at our transfer stations, our paint stores, and the recycling day events in 2015. Again, in 2016, we didn't collect at the mobile events, but these are our 2015 numbers. So it's a good amount of paint that's been collected and recycled. The paint is collected at the stores, and then we have an agreement that that paint's been picked up by a contractor called Stericycle, and then they take it to the transfer station, and it kind of gets lumped up with the other paint that is collected from residents at the transfer stations. And then all that paint ends up at in Nashville for recycling, and the oil goes to a number of different cement kilns depending on needs and in those different locations. And the paint, when we collect it at the mobile events, would go to Amazon and Environmental, and the oil would be shipped to the same locations and the cement kilns. And it's repurposed as like fuel, basically, the oil.
And Metro does their own recycling, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Metro Paint does their own recycling. I'll briefly talk about that. Yeah. So why isn't paint going to Metro? So back in, it says 1999, we used to send our paint over there. Sorry, I haven't looked at this presentation since I did it, so I'm referring back to it. So we used to send our paint to Metro, and Metro just kind of reached capacity, and they no longer, since it is going across the state lines, they wanted to focus more on their jurisdiction, and they decided to no longer collect paint from Clark County as well as other areas that they were collecting from. So they weren't just singling us out. And so we decided to figure out a different location and then something that's more sustainable, so we're not, the fluctuations of Metro's needs, you know, don't then determine what we end up doing, because we had to cease recycling latex paint because of that, and that's not a fun thing to have to do and tell residents. So, and during that time, we had to solidify and landfill it, which is what most counties do with latex paint, because they just solidify and landfill it, they do not recycle. So our mobile collection events again, these are amounts that we collected. I think I pretty much covered that. We've done mobile hazardous waste collections since 1986. So it was a while that we did them, and then we included, because latex paint used to be hazardous because of the additives in it, and so it went through this sort of transition period where it was hazardous, and then it became non-hazardous. But that's kind of hard for the public to understand if they have hazardous. And so our residents were more. So that's why it's kind of been included and continue to be included. So the paint take back program, which is what the CPG helps us fund. So it's not really product stewardship, because the paint stores aren't paying into it to help with this program. It's CPG funded, and our county, you know, resources go into it. But the idea is to buy paint from a paint store, so you can return the paint at a paint store. And so we have a number of paint locations that have signed up to be those locations to collect paint from residents. And currently, so the county pays for the transportation, because the oil is a hazardous, as the oil-based paint is a hazardous, so it has to be transported with certain rules and codes, And so since we collect that and the latex, we contract with Stericycle, who is approved to transport those materials. But once that paint gets to the transfer stations, CRC then picks up the cost of actually disposing and properly processing that paint. So these are materials that are accepted and not accepted. If paint care legislation or paint stewardship legislation went through, this would be pretty much the same. So if that paint care bill went through and we were able to have that in our county, our residents are already trained on what's approved and what's not. So just convenient. So it's free for stores to participate. The only thing they need to do is train their employees so that they're collecting the right materials. And that's what we mostly ask. And we do have a new Ace Hardware location. I haven't been able to contact again the other Ace Hardware that was initially interested. But you can, so now there are 10 paint stores throughout the county that are collecting, which was all Miller paints, both Park Rose locations and the other locations that you see, including the North County Hardware, which services the Yakult and Amboy area, which is nice to get a location up there where people aren't very close to the transfer station. So you can kind of see where things are distributed. And that new Ace Hardware is right here-ish, it's like in here. So now we have a facility that kind of services this western side of Vancouver. So it's really close to the downtown area, and it's in Hazelville.
No planning garrison.
Or no, the other Ace Hardware.
The one?
No, the new Park Rose?
No. Oh yeah, there's the new Park Rose is like.
Right, no planning garrison.
And the new Ace Hardware. On Hyang and Mihawk. So there's kind of a history of the paint stores that have just kind of signed up. So we're not out there actively seeking paint stores to sign up. We want people that, you know, are gonna, if they have an interest, then we know it'll be successful. And also we're kind of waiting for maybe some paint stewardship program to come about. We don't want to start adding extra expenses. But you can see it started with just a few. And then gradually we've just been adding more. So in 2017, we've already added another store because they came to us in interest. Well, Julie Gilbertson at the City of Vancouver, she made that initial connection and then was able to connect me with them. So that's good. So back to the question of why is there paint recycling in Clark County though? Like, why are we doing it and no other county? What makes us so special? So like I talked about before with how latex paint was hazardous and we were collecting it for that. So gradually through, because we have a contract for our transfer stations and hauling, and per that contract there are hazardous waste facilities that need to be operated by the CRC. It's kind of just been, this is what we collect, this is what we do. And then as the transition happened, those services continue to be provided by Waste Connections. Even though latex paint was no longer hazardous, they continue to provide that service, which is a great benefit to the community. There's no requirement in our contract saying CRC must collect latex paint from residents, but they've decided to continue with this, which has been great. So it's great to have Waste Connections and CRC participating. So that's kind of the history of the contract. So in 2006, the contract was renewed, and there was this addition that once the East County Transfer Station, or the Washington Transfer Station, was up and operating, that CRC would then start paying for the cost of the processing hazardous waste, because beforehand the county picked up that bill. And so Waste Connections, or the CRC, now pays for the hazardous waste disposal of the facilities, which now includes the paint as well. I mean, there's a little bit of a benefit with them doing this. They're, part of our contract is a minimum annual recycling requirement. So it does kind of help that they're recycling paint. I mean, that's, you know, quite a few tons that they can now include in this number. It's not a huge significance, but you can kind of see it as a benefit. So, yeah.
What's Mark?
Minimum annual recycling requirement. I So again, the Columbia Research Company is doing a great service to the community. Once pain care type model was implemented, if it's implemented this year, hopefully, residents will already be trained on what to do, and so will our pain stores. So all those pain stores have then become pain care locations. Our transfer stations would be a pain care location as well. Also, Stericycle is looking into possibly opening a paint processing facility. I haven't heard back from them lately, though, to see where they are, on that. As you saw, our paint gets sent quite a distance away to be recycled instead of going over the river. So if Stericycle opened something up, then they would probably be the hub for all paint in Washington State for recycling, especially if paint care went to the place. So again, when I was at this conference, the big question was, is this something that could take place in the rest of the state? And the short answer is no. We really need paint stewardship in Washington State, and Clark County should not be something that people can look to as a model for paint recycling. So, and this kind of leads into the legislative, I think that's the last slide anyways, but the legislative update. So paint care or paint product stewardship is one of the bills in addition to what Peter's been talking about with the CPG surcharge and all that stuff. So again, I mean, SWAC always has the opportunity to make a statement for any legislation. So if paint care or products, paint stewardship is something that you guys want to do, we can help you do that. And do you have any questions?
Is there a bill now? What do you know the which one?
Like the number?
Yeah.
I'll pull that up right now. I have it. So I can just take some time to talk. So the I saw this is it's 1376. Having trouble navigating this window, but it's a paint stewardship bill, so that's the bill regarding paint stewardship. And the up here are the sponsors representing it, their legislature. So that's the bill. I don't think we've looked at it in detail yet.
We passed out of House Committee. But the Senate, I don't think, Senate Environment Committee is a little bollocks up because the chair is currently working elsewhere.
Yeah.
So it hasn't got any movement. And I believe last year it passed the House, but didn't go anywhere in the Senate.
Right.
Died there.
It was my understanding it was the chair, like you speak of, that really blocked it last year. So, we'll see what happens.
He's still the chair.
Yeah.
Well, we're almost to 8, but I was going to just very quickly, I'm trying to find which of these has the one. So we get an update periodically from the Washington State Association of Counties, WASAC. We work with them on a lot of issues, as far as supporting local governments, counties, obviously, on issues that are in front of the state and the legislature. The two bills that are related to solid waste that I just would give you enough introduction so you're familiar with them. One, and I'll start at the bottom, is House Bill 1276. Actually, I'm going to get some more room easier for me just to. That's the medication bill. So this is the sponsors are there. We were hoping Brandon would be here. Brandon Vick's one of the sponsors of this. But real quickly, it's a bill regarding electronic recycling. And I think the key thing in this updates or makes changes, they kind of have a changes, but basically there's some provisions regarding creating a way to, at least in this version, which I think is in committee but hasn't left committee, to have curbside collection of electronics. So that's one of the bills that we want to learn more and see how it moves forward, but that's one of the bills, and that's 1226. And so I don't, again, being still relatively new to the state, I don't have a lot of insight on whether this has any, can move forward or not, and I guess the overall intent of it. I don't know if anyone else has followed this more closely. But I think, again, we'll get more information. This is, House Bill 1226.
Does that sound complicated for haulers, or?
No, we're working right along, step side right along with this.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, and then the other bill that that WASAC brought to our attention was a medical. This thing going to the right spot. This is pretty lengthy, so, and this is House Bill 1027, and this has to do with, this. I think this is primarily in response to sort of the opioid epidemic that we're seeing in the region and in the country, and so this is a bill that's being proposed to create a system for medication take back. And again, I spent some time going through this, but basically, the model that it looks like they're trying to set up is that the term they use are program operators, and that's defined in front of the bill here. Program operators are an organization, an organization that is covered manufacturer, a group of covered manufacturers that implements or intends to implement a drug take-back program. That's approved by the health department, so the health department would have oversight on this. And so again, is that the industry that's part of the distribution of medications would also establish locations. And then there's in the bill, there's descriptions of the sort of density based on population and wording in regards to accessibility, but basically to create a way to bring convenient return of medication, and then the Department of Health would also probably develop a fee structure to help facilitate and manage and guide that program. But from my interpretation, it's to create these, use the existing system, use these program operators or these or covered manufacturers to help do the collection process, and it's really just overseen and monitored by the Department of Health as conceived through this bill at this point. And the only other thing I'll add is that Dr. Melnick, the health department, very much supports this. I think there are other environmental issues around disposal of medication. A lot of stuff that goes into your toilets and septic systems doesn't get treated very well. A lot of it doesn't get treated and can reach groundwater, surface water, et cetera. So, there are other, I think, environmental benefits from this, but I think the primary driver has been the opioid epidemic and people, this is, so anyway, that's all I was going to cover on that one, but everyone knows the reference and we'll try to monitor as it progresses. The last thing is the board did write a resolution supporting this, but not the bill specifically, but I think they went as far to say that we support the concept of medication collection.
So is that it?
That's it.
Okay, anything else?
Yeah, I just wanted to, I don't know if anyone heard about this, I heard about it this morning, but it's in California, kind of relevant though, Walmart has to pay $1 million to settle a lawsuit for
allegedly it sold illegally plastic products in stores that were misleadingly labeled as biodegradable or compostable. And so part of that money is going back into their recycling programs, 50,000 of it. So apparently in California they're a bit strict on that. But 26 attorneys got together, and so I just wanted to share that.
Cool. Anything else? Anything from Well, then our next meeting is in April, correct?
May.
Oh, we're in May. Okay. All right.
Well. I guess so, Linda, I was wondering, you mentioned that surcharge. Is there a way that we can advocate for that? Is that something that you guys do very often, or should we just individually advocate for that?
You can individually, or as a
SWAC.
As a SWAC. Yeah.
Seems like it's pretty critical funding for some programs. So I don't know who would draft an advocacy letter like that. Would you do that? Staff so, draft it.
I don't from staff. Yeah, I think if the SWAC wanted to and made a approved motions we could certainly draft something for review, and the chair could work with everyone for editing, and then we help you get it move forward.
I suppose we do something like that. That's something we want to. Make a motion that we would draft a letter to advocate for the surcharge.
Okay. Is there a second?
I would second that motion.
If I could kind of tag on and maybe suggest that because of the timeline, since we don't meet maybe that'd be the kind of thing we could handle through email. If we have a concept that, we'll generally support that, and then just kind of fine-tune the language of staff drafts, maybe, and then we can circulate it in the next week or two to be maybe useful.
Yeah.
Does that work?
That's cool.
Peter, do you know of any dates that we should be aware of that would be critical to?
Theoretically, though, I think the legislature scheduled to adjourn in the fourth week of April. Prevailing thought is it's probably going to be July, but bills, there's a schedule and timeline, and I don't know it off the top of my head for bills, and at the risk of stepping into your business, I'll offer that there's two potentials to your idea. You could support this particular bill, it would augment the MOTCA account, which would help CBG, and I think I just saw one where Jefferson County SWAC simply they also just sort of wrote a general letter in support of CPG to their legislators saying, if you do it through MOTCA or you do it through other means, this is an important program to Jefferson County and are critical, and they did that. So the point is, that's more of a budget-related bill. Budget's the last thing you're going to do, and you probably do have some time. I'd be happy to forward you the Jefferson letter and at least let you just kind of get a sense of how they formatted it. And I suspect there are others that I can get a hold of, but that one I saw yesterday. So.
In 2015, SWAC did present a letter in support of CPG and additional maintaining and supporting and sustaining the funding that we have here. So maybe there's some language in that letter too that could be incorporated.
So it sounds like the board, the SWAC is approving that we move forward to draft something for you then to work on. Okay.
I like that language of considering the surcharge or considering other finance revenue streams.
We'll try to put something together that I think one communication that combines both of those concepts.
Yeah.
If that is what you guys want. Okay. Sure. Okay.
Do you have to officially
talk about that? Was a first and second, wasn't it?
Yeah.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
Anything else?
Such a naughty catch to
the Well, we are adjourned at 10. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for coming out here.